Welcome to Race, Violence, and Medicine. I am Dr. Brian H. Williams, and our guest today is Daniel Vaughn. Daniel is the barbecue editor for the Texas Monthly magazine. But before I get to Daniel, I want to talk to you and thank you for tuning into the show. We started this endeavor, I guess it's been about 6 weeks. We are now on episode 5. And if you've been tuning in, you probably recognize that our production value is improving with each show. And you probably also noticed that today I've actually changed the name of the show. We used to be called Unmasked for a variety of reasons, but I've been thinking about changing the name to Race, Violence, and Medicine for a few weeks because I felt that that better encapsulated the spirit of the show. And then actually, my last conversation with Daniel was kind of the last push where I decided, yeah, let's go ahead and do this. So thanks for tuning in. Keep tuning in, and now that we have Daniel, let's get to him.
So we're talking about the medicine part today, right? Barbecue.
So you're probably wondering, what the heck does barbecue have to do with race, violence, or medicine? Well, it does, and the man to tell you that tale is going to be Daniel Vaughn, so just stick with this. So Daniel, welcome to the show today. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me here, Brian.
So you recently wrote an article in Texas Monthly magazine called, I have it here, How African-American Visitors Found Texas Barbecue During the Jim Crow Era. But before we get to that article, we're going to get to that for sure. I wanted to hear about your backstory because you have a very interesting pathway to where you are right now.
Yeah, I write about Texas barbecue, and I didn't go to school for journalism, and I'm not from Texas. I grew up in Ohio, went to school in New Orleans, and moved to Texas to be an architect. And worked as an architect for 12 years here for a couple of great firms. And, well, I just fell in love with Texas barbecue as soon as I moved here. I'd never had smoked brisket in Ohio. Like, brisket meant, like, it was going to be corned beef. That's right. Pretty much it. Ribs came from Applebee's or Chili's, you know. So moving here and, like, tasting smoked meat just changed my whole worldview about what barbecue is, what barbecue could be. And I caught that bug and just really used barbecue as a way to further introduce myself to Dallas and to Texas. To Texas in a wider sense. So started reading the Texas Monthly Top 50 Barbecue Lists and using those as guides to go take some big road trips and really discover all these different styles of Texas barbecue all over the place. Started writing about it on a blog. Visited enough places that Texas Monthly started to take notice of my wide variety of barbecue joint reviews. And they contacted me because they wanted me to partner with them on an app, on a barbecue finder app, and they wanted to use my reviews to help populate that. They had 50 reviews from their latest top 50, and they wanted quite a few more to really round it out. And that was in 2011, and I made part of my contract stipulation that I would be on the tasting team for the top 50 barbecue list that was coming up in 2013. So Texas Monthly does a list back then it was every 5 years, now it's every four, a top 50 barbecue list, and I wanted to be part of it. Like, right. That had been a goal of mine as I was eating barbecue all over the state, is like, I think I could really be useful here.
So that must be a prestigious honor to be on that list.
Oh, yeah. It's an honor to be on the list, and I thought it was a huge honor to be part of the tasting team as well. I'm looking back on it now, I'm sure they were just like, good, we got another stomach on the team here.
Right.
Like, we got somebody else to take up some of these barbecue joints to go eat there. But it was really fun and really interesting to see the way that the list came together. That was the 2013 list. Now, I didn't have, say, like dictatorial power on what places were going to be on that list, but it came out just a month after I was named barbecue editor at Texas Monthly. So whether I had all the say in which joints went on there, it didn't matter. When the list came out, I was the barbecue editor, and everything was my fault.
Right.
Any place that made it or didn't make it was mine. So then we did it 4 years later, the 2017 list. That list came out in the June issue last year.
So is it fair to say, as the editor, you're sort of somewhat of a kingmaker when it comes to Texas barbecue?
Yeah, I guess so. I mean, certainly once you make it on the Texas Monthly Top 50, it's prestigious. It's certainly the barbecue joints who are on it see it as an honor. But more importantly for them, it just gives them a lot more business.
Right.
People use that list as a guide for where they're going to take their summer road trips. You know, they use that when they're traveling to any city, like look up and see what's in the Texas Monthly Top 50. So being on that list automatically means you're going to get a lot more barbecue business. That's for sure.
Okay. Well, speaking of barbecue, before the show, you took me to a famous barbecue joint right down the road from here. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, well, we went to Hardeman's Barbecue. So Hardeman's is, right now they have three locations in the Dallas area. My favorite is at Keyston Hampton. That's the one we went to. Hardeman's is one of those places that's not really all that well known currently in Dallas amongst the, you know, the barbecue hounds who travel around. But it is one of the most important barbecue joints in Dallas. It's the oldest black-owned barbecue joint. And it's the second oldest family-owned barbecue joint behind Sonny Bryan's.
So the oldest black-owned joint in Dallas.
Yes.
And the second oldest family-owned joint in Dallas.
Right. Okay. So, I mean, Sonny Bryan's is a huge name. Hardeman's should be equally as big.
Right.
And the Hardeman's started out in Freedmanstown. That's what is now Uptown. So when all the white folks from downtown kicked out all the black folks from Freedmanstown, they had to go somewhere. So
someone that's not from Dallas, what's the history of Freedmanstown?
So Freedmanstown is where, well, it was basically, that was the black neighborhood.
It was a historically black neighborhood.
Historically black neighborhood, which also meant that it was historically underserved as far as, paved roads, electricity, plumbing, all those things. So as soon as downtown started to fill out and get crammed up with people, they decided, well, let's go across this border and let's just kick all these people out who we didn't care about before.
So when you say kick people out, we're going to say gentrified is a...
probably more violent than gentrification. Right. So the Hardeman family moved to West Dallas. At that time, West Dallas was unincorporated. It was its own city. They moved to West Dallas and opened a Hardeman's Barbecue there. And, you know, they moved around locations. You might know Odom's Barbecue over on Singleton. That was one of the original Hardeman's Barbecue locations. And now, like I said, there's three of them still carrying on that legacy.
Okay. So back to you were an architect before, moved over to barbecue. Talk to us about that transition.
The transition. Well, other than the fact that I always get asked, like, don't you want to design barbecue joints? It's like, I would think
that maybe there's a lot of people out there that are struggling with, you know, giving up their comfort and their finances and their prestige to pursue a passion that is unrelated to what they've done as far as their training.
Yeah, I mean, I certainly took a pay cut, like just salary-wise, to become a journalist. I think that's not a surprise to anybody.
Right.
But what I gained is like this freedom of being able to travel the state and, you know, the country. I mean, this gig has taken me to eat barbecue, and I was in Madrid earlier this year to eat Texas barbecue. I just got back from a trip to Hawaii that I was invited to go to this barbecue event and cover it there. And also a barbecue joint that the Grand Wailea Hotel had just opened up, so they wanted me to try that. So it has taken me places where I'll be in the midst of in a scene like that and just be like, if I was an architect, there's no way I would be here right now.
Right. That's pretty impressive.
Now my convincing my wife, on the other hand, that was a little more trouble, but we've got things worked out now. We're in a comfortable place.
I guess I should let you know if you're listening that Daniel's actually my neighbor, so our families hang out together quite often. And
by neighbor, like right across the alley.
Close enough that his barbecue setup, the smells torture most of the neighborhood most days of the week, so that's pretty impressive. But let's talk about your setup for the barbecue novice. What do you have in your backyard to rival some of the joints around the
In the backyard, I have a couple of steel offset smokers for like long cooks. I've got a concrete block pit for whole hogs. I've got a Weber grill for just straight up charcoal cooking, a Big Green Egg as well, a PK grill, and a gas grill. Now the gas grill is reserved for hot dogs for kids' parties. Okay. That's the only reason to fire that thing up.
It serves no purpose other than hot dogs for kids.
It is for hot dogs for kids' parties. There's no other reason I would fire up the gas grill.
Right.
Yeah.
So,
as far as the topography goes, my house is my backyard is a little higher than yours. So, Yeah, any smoke coming off of my smokers is pretty much going right into your back door.
And drives the dog crazy every now and then as well. But it's always a smoke, so let's send the kids over to the Daniel's house to play today.
Well, and also, Brian being the good neighbor, I had a pilot of a TV show run, and the watch party was at your house.
Right. Yeah.
Thank you for hosting.
Yeah, let's talk about that show, because it had a recent...
Well, Smokelandia. Yeah. So it's just a pilot right now. It's the one episode, and it's airing on the Cooking Channel. I don't know how many more times it will air. I'm hoping they just go ahead and give us the green light to make a full season of it. That's the hope.
So what is the basis of the show?
Well, we...
I've seen it, obviously. I also watched it with you, but...
Yeah, I mean, we find all of the best, like, salad-based restaurants around Texas. We pretty much just eat kale, iceberg, spinach, like... It's really about comparing all these different greens and pairing them with dressings. No, it's a barbecue show that goes nationwide.
Right.
So instead of focusing just on Texas, Texas will still have a big part in this show. But it's about going all over the country and really finding some of those unknown barbecue joints and really just highlighting the styles and cooking methods that you find outside of Texas as well as in Texas.
Right. And speaking of traveling, you drive cross country quite a bit, fly to these different joints?
Well, most of the time I'm driving, yeah. I mean, there's a whole lot that I can get to. Like, I drop the kids off at school, so that means I can be on the road by 8. And so most barbecue joints open at 11. I can get to a whole lot of places within that 3-hour radius from Dallas. So that's Texarkana, Abilene, and down to Austin. So I'm generally driving around. Now, certainly if I'm going to head out to El Paso, it's a little easier to fly. I need to get down to the Rio Grande Valley. It's been a couple of years now, and I really have a few places to get down to there. That'll be a flight down to Brownsville or Harlingen or somewhere around there.
Well, fortunately, you can travel safely by car anywhere you want to get barbecue. But there was a time in this country where it was not safe for African Americans to drive across the country. And there was this book called The Negro Motorist Green Book, which Daniel describes in this article, which we're going to talk about when we come back from the break. So stick with us. You are listening to Race, Violence, and Medicine, and this is IamRoyaltyRadio.com. Guest today is Daniel Vaughn. He is the barbecue editor for the Texas Monthly magazine. And Daniel, you know, we went to have barbecue beforehand. We've been talking about barbecue. When I think about barbecue, two things come to mind: either having sweet tea, which don't have any of that right now, or beer. Now, we don't have a barbecue grill in here, but we do have a fridge. So I'm gonna go over here and get us pop up some cold ones.
Oh wow! I didn't know.
Where you're listening from? If you can, go ahead and get yourself a cocktail right now. This is about the time to do it.
I didn't know we were gonna get some of that. I like this. Like, I mean, everybody likes to have beer with barbecue. I love to have beer while I'm cooking barbecue.
Yeah.
Yeah. So being able to have something by the grill or by the smoker. Oh, here we got a situation. We got an opener. Who's got a bottle opener around here? But yeah, so I love to drink beer while I'm cooking the barbecue.
Tying the sips.
Now when I'm drinking while I'm eating barbecue, so I'm a big fan of Berliner Weiss beers. Anybody who reads my stuff knows that I constantly go on and on about Berliner Weiss beers, which are getting more and more popular. But let's see, we got a
cheers.
A Mosaic IPA from Community here. Cheers, thank you.
Well, you know I'm partial to IPAs, and I try to always support our local breweries, and this is one of my favorite local IPAs.
Yes, I know that if I come over to Brian's house for a beer, I'm going to get a little pucker with it, all those hops. If it's too hoppy for me, I know I can just send it your way.
Let's get back to your recent article. called How African American Visitors Found Texas Barbecue During the Jim Crow Era. Tell us the impetus.
I mean, we're talking about the Green Books here, and the Green Books were really important for African American travelers at the time. They were published between 1936 and 1966. This is during the Jim Crow era. By 1939, they had gone nationwide. It was started by Victor H. Green. He was a postal worker in New York. And so the first guides were really just about places that were safe in New York. And when I say places, I'm talking about hotels, restaurants, service stations, and hotels is pretty generous because many of the places for lodging listed here are simply people's houses.
Right.
People that you could contact, people that you could stay in their extra room, because that's how hard it was to find a hotel room for an African-American traveler at the time. So, you know, that was the time of, like, during the rise of Highway or Route 66, right? And so it was all about this freedom of the road. But every traveler that they depicted on images of Route 66 were white.
Right.
I mean, if you look back, so Candace Taylor, she's an expert on the Green Books and about travel back at that time. And 44 of the 89 counties that lined Route 66 were home to sundown towns, meaning they had signs, or at least you know, people were supposed to know that if you weren't white, you shouldn't be caught in that town at sundown. That's more than half of those counties. So not only was it tough to find, it was tough to find counties that were safe to be driving through at night, let alone safe places to stay or places that were going to welcome in African American travelers.
So, and this is in the 30s, 40s,
this
50s,
is 30s,
60s.
40s, 50s, and 60s, yeah.
And many would argue that some of that's still present today.
Yeah, that's for sure. Well, you know, at this time, I mean, we talk about these guides as, you know, we talk about them as this thing that is this resource that shows all of these places that you can go to. But in 1939, there were 5 restaurants total listed in Texas. I mean, these are 5 restaurants that felt comfortable putting their name in this guide.
So only 5 restaurants in the entire state of Texas.
In the state of Texas.
That was safe for Black Americans to patronize.
Right, if they're using this book as their guide, for sure.
So this book is a crowdsourcing kind of guide?
I don't think it was a crowdsourcing kind of guide, because I really feel like there would have been more listed. One of the problems that I had, even talking to some of the experts of the Green Books, is getting some determination on how these places went into the book. Were they nominated? Did it have to be, was there a vetting process? Did they have to volunteer to be in the book? Because the other thing is, if you're in this book and you're, you know, in a white neighborhood, that's not going to be welcome that you're bringing in African Americans,
right,
you're bringing in Black travelers. That's not going to be something that's welcomed. So if your neighbors find out that you're in that book and they don't like it, they're going to let you know. But yeah, I was at least proud as the barbecue editor to know that of those 5 places in Texas in 1939, and by the way, by 1966, it was only 20-some restaurants in all of Texas. But back in 39, 5 of those 5 places, 2 of them were barbecue joints. So one was called Beaumont Barbecue here in Dallas, and the other one was called Long Barbecue in Beaumont. So a little confusing there, but
right.
Beaumont Barbecue was in Dallas, Long Barbecue was in Beaumont, and those 2 barbecue joints remained on the list in those Green Books all the way through to the last issue, and they were the only 2 barbecue joints listed in Texas all the way through that time.
Really?
As well.
So this is the story behind this Beaumont Barbecue here,
yes,
in Dallas. Because that was kind of the impetus for this story, right?
Yeah. yes. So I found, I was looking through the Green Books, and I found, you know, these 2 barbecue joint names. And, you know, you go back and look through the records, look through old newspapers and everything, anything that I could find to try and paint a picture of what these places might have looked like, and what the pitmasters may have, you know, get a little story about who they were. And Tom Foward, kind of an odd last name, right?
Right.
So Tom Foward, he's the guy who ran Beaumont Barbecue. So, of course, I'm searching for Tom Foward, and there's not a whole lot of hits because it is kind of an odd last name spelling. So Tom Foward showed up in this story about this huge police car chase all the way from Corsicana up into Dallas. And, I mean, it was like...
And that's about how far distance?
I mean, that's like 80 miles.
Okay.
You know, this is 80 miles in, like, 1937, I think, is when this, or 36,
right,
is when this story was written. And He was with a woman named Callie Lilly. That might have been an alias because I couldn't find a record of a Callie Lilly anywhere, and I'm pretty sure he was married to somebody else at that time, so he probably just gave a fake name.
Right.
The story of this police chase just was like this fantastic, almost Hollywood story. Like, you know, the cops in Corsicana are after him, and he just outruns them on the highway. They radio up to Dallas. He gets into Dallas, and the cops are on his tail, and he like jumps these railroad tracks right in front of a train, and the train passes, not allowing any of the police cars to follow him. He makes his way all the way through Dallas and then gets stuck in a traffic jam in North Dallas. And I'm like, even in 1936,
right,
you get stuck in a traffic jam in North Dallas. Like, how little things change.
So I think it's fair to say you're a barbecue editor doesn't really capture what you all do. You're kind of an historian as well.
Well, like, you know, I certainly write a lot of barbecue joint reviews, and
right,
and the top 50 list is the biggest thing that comes out in Texas Monthly that's barbecue related. So I'm viewed by a lot of people as I'm a judge of barbecue joints. Or I'm a barbecue critic.
Right.
And I certainly do perform that role, but I enjoy much more looking back at these historical records and trying to paint pictures of really unknown pitmasters, right? And more often than not, the unknown pitmaster is one who was probably black.
Right.
Because there's plenty written about the white guys. And so going back and trying to find real detail on these people, like almost everything else I found about Beaumont Barbecue in the newspaper was about when somebody broke in and stole some cigarettes from the cigarette machine,
right,
or they stole their cash box or whatever, right? That's about the only time I saw any mention of Beaumont Barbecue in the newspapers. But seeing this about Tom Foward, now, the reason I found it so interesting for this story in particular is that it all started with an altercation at a service station. He got in an argument over gas prices with the guy running the place. The guy running the place then threw a water bottle at him, which back in that time was probably not going to be plastic.
Right.
Threw a water bottle at his car, probably threw a glass bottle at his car. And then Foward allegedly took out a pistol and shot the roof of the service station over the guy's head.
Okay.
And, like, you know, this is pure speculation, but, you know.
And Foward's black?
Foward's black. And the gas station owner was white. And so, you know, the first thought that comes to my head, okay, what's this argument over gas prices? Well, I'm sure that it's gas prices are one thing for white people,
right,
and different for black people. That's going to cause an argument. And the owner probably felt like there was going to be no consequences of him throwing a water bottle at a black man's car.
Right.
Nobody's going to get him in trouble for that. So I'd like to think, like, I have no proof of this, but I'd like to think that altercation helped Tom Foward understand the value of having his restaurant listed as a safe place for travelers to come to.
From there he became a pitmaster, right?
Yeah, so he came to Dallas and he opened Beaumont Barbecue. Now, the thing that I could never figure out, or that I couldn't really square in my mind, is how did this black guy who had this altercation, allegedly fired a pistol, had a court case, how was he running a barbecue joint like a few years later? Why wasn't he in jail? And it didn't make any sense,
right,
because he certainly wasn't going to get off because of a sympathetic jury or something,
sure,
right? So I talked to the county clerk down in Navarro County where this case was, and he went back in the old records and he found that 2 years later that case had been dropped for lack of evidence. So he never ended up having to go to court for it.
Just shocking.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I want to talk more about the lives of black pitmasters from some of your research. We'll do that after the break. But we're here with Daniel Vaughn. He is the barbecue editor for the Texas Monthly magazine. You're listening to I Am Radio, iamroyaltyradio.com. You can also download the app. And it's not just me here at the station. We have several other talk shows. You can check out This and That Sports, BAM Radio, Tie in the Sips. Who else we got? The Ultimate Takeover with Lady J Sleem and JD doing news and events. So pretty much almost every weekday night there's another talk show, and you can catch this show here every Tuesday and Thursday at 4 p.m. Eastern, 3 p.m. Central. Stick with us. We'll be back after a short break. Welcome back to Race, Violence, and Medicine. I'm your host, Dr. Brian H. Williams. We are here with Daniel Vaughn talking barbecue, police car chases, and the lives of black barbecue pitmasters back in the day. So I recall you telling me a story, or was it, I may have been in your article, you talked about, like, how did black pitmasters manage to stay in business in the era of Jim Crow?
Yeah, well, I mean, first of all, they had to make a choice. Were they going to cater to a white audience or a black audience? And for a lot of pitmasters, that was obviously a tough choice. So you take, like, Robert Petillo down in Beaumont, and he's just very straight up about it. His grandfather decided that they were going to cater to whites first and that black customers were going to eat in the back. He said it was purely an economic choice. That's probably kind of cold to hear in this day and age. Certainly, Petillo's barbecue is wide open to anybody right these days, but that was a choice that they made back then. And whereas, you know, right across the street from Petillo's at one point was Long Barbecue, and Long Barbecue was one of the ones listed in the green books that we were talking about. So Ed Long ran that place, and it was right next to the Star Theater. The Star Theater was the black theater in Beaumont at the time.
So let me get this straight. There's a black-owned barbecue that catered to whites across the street from a black-owned barbecue that catered to blacks next to the
next to the Black Theater, okay, in, like, the happening black neighborhood in town, Forsyth Street.
Right.
It's hard to say fast, especially after half an IPA here. But that district was really well known as, like, this really hopping place to be, this thriving black neighborhood in Beaumont. And Robert Petillo even remembers it back in the day where on a Saturday night or Friday night, like, you couldn't drive down Forsyth, because it was so packed with people that there was no point in trying to drive.
Right.
Because it was just so popular. And so there was a couple of barbecue joints along it. Now, Petillo's ended up moving out, and Long Barbecue closed sometime in the 60s. But yeah, Forsyth was really big.
I guess I shouldn't be surprised. I mean, I shouldn't be surprised when I hear the story that...
Oh, and sorry to interrupt, but the other thing I want to bring up is, so in Beaumont at that time, there were... in like 1940, in the directory, the city directory in 1940, I think there were 9 barbecue joints. 8 of them were black-owned barbecue joints, and only one of them was listed in the green books. So again, it's like a further mystery as to how a place might have been listed or not listed in the green books.
Right. So economic survival dictated that you had to participate in this racial caste system, even though it affected you. I can't even imagine how that would affect somebody's feelings about themselves and
right
people.
Feelings and about themselves, their community.
Right.
Yeah.
But also, I guess if you're listening, Beaumont is in the news now because of the immigration issue, right, that's in the news right now, where people crossing the border are being detained and separated from their families. So Beaumont has a long history in Texas.
Well, and at the time, back in the 40s, there was a big race riot in Beaumont.
Right.
And so the dock workers at the time, there was a rumor going around that that a white girl had been raped. It was untrue, by a black man.
Right.
So the dock workers, who were mainly white, they got themselves all riled up, or somebody probably got them riled up, and they headed over to Forsyth Street and started burning buildings, breaking windows. So there's no record about what happened to Long Barbecue, but in an African-American newspaper in Pittsburgh, like a year later, they did talk about, go to Long's Barbecue, it's newly renovated. I'm like, wonder why it's newly renovated at the time.
And that's a story that played out countless times across this country in so many cities as some pretense to go destroy black neighborhoods. It's sad part of our history that must be reckoned with and acknowledged. So we have these black pitmasters that are fighting for economic survival, participating in this racial caste system. How do you feel driving around Texas now, knowing all of this history? Because you have a window that most people don't have when they walk into a restaurant. Like,
well, I mean, I guess the biggest thing that it's taught me, that research has taught me, and just eating all over Texas, is that the idea of sliced brisket being the be-all, end-all of Texas barbecue is a very white-centric viewpoint. That's Central Texas barbecue, and Central Texas barbecue was started by, white immigrants mainly, who were opening meat markets at the time, butcher shops, and were serving barbecue as leftovers from those meat markets. Now, there's a lot of argument back and forth. The Texas barbecue was started by, was it a black thing? Was it a white thing? I think the question that people are really trying to come up with is, how did commercial barbecue begin in Texas? And it was both. Right around the same time, late 1880s, early 1890s, meat markets, generally white-owned meat markets in Central Texas, even coming as far up into Waco and into Dallas as well, were serving their leftovers as barbecue. At the same time, in the cities, barbecue shacks that were both white-owned and black-owned were opening up and, cooking in pits out behind the restaurant and serving barbecue then. So the rise of commercial barbecue was really both races. And if you look back at how Texas barbecue first migrated into Texas, I mean, that was all really coming through the migration is a mild term for it, but the forced migration of black Americans as the enslaved, right, coming into East Texas. So they were bringing their barbecue secrets, all of the barbecue techniques and everything that they were learning in South Carolina and Mississippi and Alabama and all the way across, they were making their way into East Texas as well and doing that same style of cooking where you're cooking whole animals over a trench, cooking wood down to coals, mopping it with some sort of flavored mop that provides your seasoning. And, of course, all the while getting zero credit for any of it.
Sure.
So if a big barbecue event was listed in the newspaper, it was generally listed who the credit was usually given to who's throwing the barbecue. Well, that was the white man who could afford,
right,
to have the trenches dug or whatever, who had the land to do it. It wasn't the black men who were cooking it. So that's something that's even harder to reconcile or I guess harder to go back and try and give credit to those people because they're almost entirely unnamed.
Right. So you're a journalist for the Texas Monthly Magazine, but you're also an author.
Mm-hmm.
You want to talk? Tell us about your book.
Well, so I have a book, The Prophets of Smoked Meat. So it came out 5 years ago. It was the
Prophets of Smoked Meat.
That's right, and that's the religious prophets, not the money, because generally in smoked meat, there's not a ton of the green stuff.
Right.
So it was the first book that was published in Anthony Bourdain's line of books. Rest in peace, and. It was.
So you're essentially on his label? Is that what would that? Would
yeah.
You call that?
Yes.
Okay.
And he was really generous to come and find this unknown barbecue writer because I signed that book deal before I had the job with Texas Monthly.
Okay.
This is still when I was just a blogger about Texas barbecue. So, it was a really incredible reach on his end to go out and be that generous to give me that deal.
Did you get to meet him in person, or is this?
Oh yeah, I met him. Hung out with him and had drinks with him and spent time with him, and it was an incredibly sad day. It was bittersweet yesterday. They were his show was nominated for multiple Emmys,
right.
So they'll surely win some of those, and all of them will be posthumously for him.
Right.
So, but I'm also working on another book with right now with Sam Jones of Sam Jones Barbecue in Winterville, North Carolina. So I'm going from Texas way over to the other side to Whole Hog Barbecue in Eastern North Carolina.
And what's that book will be about? Are you keeping that under
wraps? Oh yeah, I'm keeping that under wraps. I think the cover will be released here soon. And that book's not going to come out till next year.
Okay. All right, you're listening to Race, Violence, and Medicine. This is Dr. Brian H. Williams. We're going to take another break. You're listening to I Am Royalty Radio. Stick with us, and we'll come back for our final segment with Daniel Vaughn, who is the barbecue editor, I would say, / historian for Texas Monthly Magazine. Stick with us. Welcome back. I'm Dr. Brian H. Williams. You're listening to Race, Violence, and Medicine. We are here with Daniel Vaughn, who is the barbecue editor for the Texas Monthly Magazine. We've been having a fascinating discussion about race and barbecue. And
we got some violence in there, too.
Yeah, I guess there was some violence. We had, this has been quite an interesting show about history of barbecue in Texas and actually across the country. So thank you for sharing that with us, Dan.
No, it's been a lot of fun because most of the time I get on a show like this and I'm like, where's the best barbecue in Texas?
Right.
It's like, that's an uninteresting question.
Well, you're the vegetarians.
I got you to eat a rib today, though.
I tried one of those ribs for you today.
That's right.
But you saw my eyes glass over when you mentioned all these different places. And I'm like, I don't know that place. I don't know that place either.
Yeah. I also saw you put your hand up when I offered the pork chop, too. Like, I don't like to sit down for a meal with less than two meats.
Right. So, you're writing, you're working on a book. What's next for you? You talked about the TV show?
Yeah, well, I mean, I'm hoping that TV show gets picked up, and then, that'll send me all over the country doing some more searching, hopefully taking me to places that I haven't been. So I'm looking forward to see if that happens.
And what's that called again?
Smokelandia.
Smokelandia on the Cooking Channel.
On the Cooking Channel, that's right. But, my job with Texas Monthly, it takes me all over. So I've been taking a lot of trips here lately, and I have a lot to write about. So the next couple of weeks is going to be sitting down and like getting all that down, getting it up on the website or in the magazine to finally get all these places that I've already been to, get something written about them. And, then it's going to be back out on the road. I've got some places in the Panhandle to go check out. Like I said, I need to schedule that flight down to the Rio Grande Valley. That's just basically my schedule is just based on where has it been that I've taken the longest to get back to, just kind of make my way all around the state. So I was just out in El Paso. I was just up in North Texas not too long ago. I mean, I'm going down to the office at Texas Monthly. I'm down in Austin pretty regularly anyway. So, yeah, just drive around and eat some barbecue.
Okay, let's shift gears from barbecue just for a moment there. Just talk about your writing process, because you're writing all these columns, you're writing a book. What's your writing process? And I know that's kind of vague.
My writing process is like find time to write and then do it.
So you don't light incense and candles?
And no incense. No incense and candles. No, my process is best driven by deadlines that are very nearby.
Right.
So it's that sort of that sort of push. Like I was listening to a interview from Nigella Lawson, and she was saying there are people who are driven by goals and driven by fear, and she was talking about everybody, but really specifically about writers. And she described herself as somebody who's driven by fear, and I'm definitely the same way.
Okay.
I am driven by the fear of missing a deadline, making people unhappy. Not getting an opinion that I want out there on time, or not getting a story that I want out there to coincide with something. So that's what I'm pretty much driven by in my writing.
Well, I'll say about your writing, when I read it, I feel like I'm there, and you bring me into the story. It's not like you're lecturing me about something.
Well, and that's certainly been a work in progress. Right. Like I'm 5 years into this job now, and I had no training as a journalist or a writer. Most of my writing before then had just been persuasive writing via email. That's what you do when you have to talk to clients at an architecture firm. So most of my writing hadn't been like in the narrative style. So my book was one of the first things that certainly the first big project that I took on, but it's something that I've been constantly working on over the last 5 years of trying to make it better.
Right. All right, Daniel, thank you for taking time out with us today. Where can our listeners track you down later if they want to do some cyber stalking?
Yeah,
see what you're doing.
All right, well.
I'll say that in jest. That's probably not something to
I was gonna give him your address,
if I offended anybody, I apologize. That was definitely poor taste.
No, but. I am. Texas Monthly/BBQ. So TexasMonthly.com/BBQ, or you can just search for Texas Monthly Barbecue, and that's where all of my stories live on the website. Whether they were in print or just for the web, they're all going to be there. On Twitter, you can find me at @BBQSnob. And it's the same on Instagram @BBQSnob. that's pretty much the best place to get me. So people ask for my email, and I'm like, just Just shoot me a question over Twitter. I'm more likely to answer it more quickly.
All right. Well, thank you for tuning into our show today. We just had Daniel Vaughn, barbecue editor for the Texas Monthly. This is Race, Violence, and Medicine. I'm your host, Dr. Brian H. Williams. My goal is to provide you a show that when that is over, you don't feel like you wasted your time. So please go to raceviolencemedicine.com and leave a comment about the show, what you liked, what you'd like to do better. Or you can just hit me up on Twitter at BHWilliamsMD. That's at BHWilliamsMD. The show airs every Tuesday and Thursday at 4 p.m. Eastern, 3 p.m. Central at IamRoyaltyRadio.com. Or you can download the app, and it's not just me. We have music 24/7 and also several other talk shows, news with JD, This and That Sports, BAM Radio. And I also want to thank our engineer today, Ty. He has his own show, Ty and the Sips, on Tuesday nights. And I cannot forget The Ultimate Takeover with Lady Jaceline. So go to IamRoyaltyRadio.com, check out the lineup, and see if there's anything there that interests you. Appreciate you tuning into this show. And I guess I do have one last thought I want to share with y'all. We are heading into midterm election season. Actually, we're already there. In 2016, 50% of eligible voters did not cast a vote in the presidential election. 50%. So I just implore you to exercise your right to vote. Register now. Register your family and friends. Vote early. Because if your vote did not matter, they would not be working so hard to suppress it. Until next time, thanks for joining us.